He couldn't go on following rules that were made for a different time. It all made sense when he met Emily. She could make this right. She could take away this stigma. If Dulcie Shelby's daughter, of all people, could accept him for who he was, then his family would have to take notice. Emily was the first step to a whole new way of life. At this point, he couldn't even consider the possibility that he was wrong about this. He had to be right. He had to be. After breakfast, they sat side by side on the Adirondack chairs, quietly watching the sun burn the morning fog away. The beach was slowly filling with people, and the noise was beginning to swell. "Are you out here a lot in the summer?" Emily finally asked, watching a boat zoom across the lake, leaving a trail of churning water that looked like soda foam. He'd been biting his tongue, waiting for her to say something, not wanting to rush her. "My family uses this house all year round. It's a home away from home. It drives Penny crazy, though. She likes to keep to a strict schedule, and we always throw her off it by showing up unexpectedly, like I did this morning.
I get the feeling she doesn't mind. I think she adores you."
She looked over at him with a smile that made his chest feel full. He was manipulating her. He knew that. But for the first time, he realized how easily she could be doing the same to him. He needed to be her friend to make this work. He never expected to have these other feelings. One well-placed smile, and he forgot what he was going to say. All he could think was how different she was than he thought she would be, after all the stories he'd heard about her mother. She was striking and sweet, and had the most interesting hair. It always looked like a gust of wind was hiding in there, waiting to blow out. It was so endearingly quirky. In the silence that followed, her smile faded, and her hands went to her hair.
"Do I have something on my head?"
"No, sorry. I was just thinking about your hair." She gave him an odd look.
"You were thinking about my hair?"
This was the same hiccup he'd felt on the Ferris wheel with her. He couldn't lose focus. "Yes. No, I mean, I was wondering if you ever wore it down." She shook her head.
"It's in that weird growing out stage right now."
"How short was it before?"
"Really short. My mom wore her hair short, so I wore mine short too. But I started growing it out a little over a year ago."
"What made you stop wanting to be like her?"
"I've never stopped wanting to be like her. She was a wonderful person," she said vehemently. Then she turned back to the water. "It was just a lot to live up to."
This wasn't working. They had to shake some of this awkwardness off. "Let's go for a walk," he said as he stood. They left their shoes by their chairs and went back down the deck steps. They walked close to the water and got their feet wet. They didn't talk much, but that was okay. Walking together, their strides in rhythm, getting used to each other, was enough. When they reached the cove, Emily looked toward the grotto where his sister's birthday party had been held. There were two elderly couples sitting on folding chairs there today, away from the crowds and out of the sun. He knew what she was going to do before she took the first step. Without a word, Emily left him and walked away from the water toward the trees. He hesitated a moment before following her. She passed the elderly couples and went to the tree where her mother's and his uncle's initials had been carved. Wynne stopped to say hello to the elderly couples, to put their minds at ease, because they were looking at Emily strangely. Then he went to stand by her. The past few months of her life had been marked by a chaos he could only imagine. Looking at her like this, he could see her grief. He could see how alone she felt with it. But he understood that. He knew about things you couldn't tell other people, because they had no basis for comparison, because they simply wouldn't understand.
"Will the kids at Mullaby High know about my mom? About who she was here?" Emily finally asked, staring at the tree.
"If their parents tell them. You probably got the worst of it from my dad. I wouldn't worry about Mullaby High. It's not that bad."
He hated seeing her like this. He wanted to distract her.
"Tell me about your old school. Do you miss it? The website made it seem very intense."
That was putting it mildly. Roxley School for Girls was so full of righteous, politically correct indignation that a person could get a nosebleed just by reading the literature. She shrugged. After my mom died, I wanted to find some sort of comfort in the school, but I couldn't. There was just this legacy. More than ever, people there wanted me to fill my mom's shoes, and I couldn't. Ironic, isn't it, that I come here and the same thing has happened, just in a different way? And I don't know which is worse, trying to live up to her name or trying to live it down.
What about your friends there?
I started having panic attacks after my mother died, and I didn't want people to see me having them, so I started spending a lot of time by myself. He suddenly thought of her sitting on the bench downtown, with her head down. He'd been watching her for a while that morning, and he'd seen the moment something was wrong, the way she'd stopped short on the sidewalk, the color draining from her face. It had been alarming, and had forced him to approach her when he hadn't planned to at all. And that had changed everything.
"Were you having a panic attack the first day we met?"
She nodded.
"What brings them on?"
"Panic."
That made him smile. "Well, obviously."
"They come on when I start to feel overwhelmed, when there's just too much going on in my head." She suddenly seemed wary. "Why do you want to know?"
"I'm just curious."
She continued to look at him, her brows low over her bright blue eyes.
"Why are you looking at me like that?"
"I've never told anyone about my panic attacks," she said, as if he'd somehow forced it out of her. "You now know my weakness."
"You say that as if you're not supposed to have any."
He reached past her and started picking bark off the tree absently.
"We all have weaknesses."
"Do you?"
"Oh, yes."
She had no idea. He continued picking at the tree until she put her hand on his and made him stop. "And you're not going to tell me?" He took a deep breath.
"It's complicated."
"I get it," she said, and turned to walk back to the shoreline. "You don't want to tell me."
He jogged after her. "No, it's not that I don't want to tell you. It's more like I have to show you."
She stopped. He almost ran into her. "So, show me."
"I can't. Not now."
He ran his hands through his hair, frustrated.
"You'll have to trust me on that."
"I don't have much of a choice, do I?" she said. They headed around the lake, quiet again, and eventually circled back to the house. It was a long walk, and when they got back, Penny brought lunch out to them, unasked. After she set out the plates of sandwiches and fruit, she passed behind Emily's chair, still in Wynn's view. She smiled as she pointed to Emily and gave him a thumbs up before she went inside to answer the ringing phone. He smiled back at her. After they'd finished, Emily stood and walked to the railing. He followed the line of her long legs up her body to her face. He was suddenly fascinated by the progress of her hair tie as it slowly slipped out of her hair as she moved and stretched. Finally, the tie fell from the tips of her hair to the deck. She didn't seem to notice.
"I wish I had my bathing suit," she said. "I'd go cool off in the water."
"Come inside, where it's cool. I'll show you around."
When she turned, he reached over to pick up her hair tie.
"You dropped something."
She held out her hand. "Thanks." But he put it in his pocket. "You're not going to give it back?" she asked.
"Eventually," he said, as he walked into the cavernous living room off the deck.
Emily followed, arguing with him about the rights of ownership. She fell silent when she stepped inside. There weren't any paintings of sand dunes or antique wooden boys on the walls, the way he knew some of the surrounding lake house rentals were decorated, like they could double as fish house restaurants. This place actually looked like his family spent a lot of time here, which they did. The furniture was comfortable and had a bit of sag. One wall was dominated by a flat screen, and the floor under it was littered with a Wii and tons of DVDs. Overnight travel was inconvenient for them, so their vacations usually consisted of coming out to the lake and staying here.
"This is a lot more homey than I expected," she finally said.
"They can't all be ivory towers."
He led her to the second story with a cursory wave to the four bedrooms there, then up to the third story loft through a door in the linen closet. The space was occupied only by a low couch, a stack of books, a television, and some storage boxes. No one came up here but him. He loved his family, but when they were all out here, sometimes he needed a break from their togetherness. So this is where he went. He didn't like their house on Main Street as much, with its cold marble and oppressive history, but it was a lot easier to avoid people there. "I spend a lot of time in this loft when I'm here," he said as she looked around. The only light was from the windows on the far wall, stacked in the shape of a triangle that followed the line of the sloping ceiling. Pink dust motes sparkled in the air. "I can see why. It has a secret feel to it. It suits you." She walked to the bank of windows. "Great view." He watched her from across the room, backlit against the windows. He was moving before he was even aware of what he was doing. He stopped directly behind her, mere inches away. Awareness immediately radiated from her, like electricity. A full minute passed before he said, "You're suddenly quiet." He watched her swallow. "I don't understand how you do this to me." He leaned in slightly. Her hair smelled like something flowery, like the fading scent of lilacs.
"Do what?"
"Your touch."
"I'm not touching you, Emily."
She turned around. "That's just it. It feels like you are. How do you do that? It's like you have something surrounding you, something I can't see that reaches out. It doesn't make sense." That startled him. She felt it. No one had ever felt it before. She waited for him to say something, to explain or deny it, neither of which he could do. He took a step past her, closer to the window.
"Your family once owned all of this," he said.
She hesitated before deciding to accept the change of subject. "All of what?"
"All of Piney Woods Lake. Years ago, that's how the Shelbys made their money, by selling it off, parcel by parcel."
He pointed to the trees in the distance.
"All that wooded acreage on the other side of the lake still belongs to your grandfather. That's millions of dollars of potential development. It drives my father crazy. He wants your grandfather to sell him some of it."
"Why?"
"Coffees have always liked to have a say in the growth of Mullaby. Home sites, businesses, things like that."
"Why?" she asked again.
"Because this is our home. For years and years, we thought this was the only place we could live."
"Is it?" He turned to face her.
"Do you really want to know?" "My weakness."
"Yes. Yes, of course I do." This was it. There was no going back after he told her. He had to show her then.
"The men in my family have an affliction."
She looked confused. "What sort of affliction?" He left her at the window and paced across the room.
"It's genetic," he said. "A simple mutation. But it's particularly strong in my family. My grandfather had it. My uncle had it. My father has it." He paused. "I have it."
"Have what?" He took a deep breath.
"We call it the glowing."
Emily stared at him, still not understanding.
"Our skin gives off light at night," he explained,
and it was amazing, actually saying that to someone outside his family. It was as liberating as he thought it would be. It was even better. The words were out, and he couldn't take them back. He waited for Emily to say something, but she said nothing.
"That's what you feel," he said eagerly, walking back to her and putting his hands on either side of her face, almost, but not quite, touching her.
She met his eyes. "You want me to believe that you glow in the dark?" she said in a monotone.
Wynne dropped his hands. You'll believe I'm a werewolf, but not this?
I never believed you were a werewolf. He stepped back, trying not to feel defeated. He had to go on.
It goes back generations. My ancestors left the old country to avoid persecution because people assumed their affliction was the work of evil. They traveled by sea, and history is riddled with sightings of their ship, said to be a portent of doom. When they came to America, Native Americans called them spirits of the moon. They settled here when it was nothing but farmland, far away from everyone, but slowly the town grew around them. No one knew their secret, and they realized they liked it, liked not being so isolated. But the stories of persecution were always handed down, scaring us into secrecy, even in the modern world. That all changed the night your mother tricked my uncle into coming out at night. He stood on the bandstand that summer night, in front of the entire town, and for the first time, everyone saw what we could do.
That's a very elaborate story, she said.
Emily, you've seen me, in your backyard at night.
That gave her a start. You're the light in my backyard? You're the Mullaby Lights?
Yes.
He could tell her mind was working, trying to sort it all out. Then why have you stopped coming around?
I come every night. But your grandfather sits on the kitchen porch below your balcony and tells me to go away before you can see that I'm there.
My grandfather knows?
Her voice was pitching higher. Yes.
Prove it.
She looked around and saw the closet door. She walked over to it and opened it. There was nothing inside but a rain jacket and a single water ski.
Here, come here.
He walked over to her, and she herded him into the closet and followed, closing the door behind them. It was a tight fit. She waited a few moments in the pitch black before she said,
"Ha! I don't see you glowing."
"That's because it takes moonlight," he said, patiently. She snorted.
"Well, that's convenient."
"Actually, no, it's not."
"This is ridiculous," she said, and he felt her fumbling to find the doorknob.
"Wait," he said, and reached out to stop her. His hand landed on her hip, and she suddenly stilled. "Meet me tonight at the bandstand, at midnight. I'll show you."
"Why are you doing this?" she asked in a whisper. "Is this some elaborate plan?"
She caught him off guard with that. If she knew he was manipulating her, why was she letting him? "Plan?"
"For getting back at my mother? For what she did?"
"No," he said. "I told you before. I don't blame you for what she did."
"But you're recreating that night with my mother and your uncle."
"It has nice symmetry, doesn't it?"
"Okay," she said, unhappily. "I'll be there." He almost laughed.
"You don't have to sound so enthusiastic."
"This would be easier if I didn't like you so much."
"You like me?"
He felt both elated and ashamed. She didn't answer.
"How much?" he asked quietly, the air filling with tension.
"Enough to meet you tonight, even though I'm pretty sure you have something else planned, other than glowing in the dark."
"That isn't enough."
He could sense her holding her breath when she realized how close his face was to hers.
"I'm knotted up with you," he said. "Don't you feel it? From the moment we met, I was meant to show you."
"I need to go."
She opened the door, and a blinding burst of light hit them. She was gone in seconds. He caught up with her on the deck as she was putting on her shoes. "Don't go through the woods tonight. Come into the park from the street." She stood and stared at him for a long time. He started to reach out his hand, to touch her, to reassure her as much as himself, but she gave him a brief nod before turning and quickly making her way down the steps to the beach. He watched her walk away, then he put his hands in his pockets and walked slowly, thoughtfully, back into the house.
He stopped when he entered the living room. His father was sitting in the big black leather chair by the couch, his legs crossed. Wynne was so astonished he couldn't speak for a moment. He could usually feel when his father was looking for him. Finally, he said, "When did you get here?"
"Just now. I called earlier to ask you not to block your mother's car when you come home, because she's leaving early tomorrow with Kylie to go to Raleigh to shop for school clothes. Penny said you were on the beach. I asked with whom. She said a girl. I asked her to describe the girl, and it sounded like Emily Benedict. But I thought, no, Wynne knows better than that."
That must have been the phone call Penny had answered earlier. Wynne had to give her credit for doing what she could. She'd told his father he was on the beach with Emily, not that he was in the house alone with her.
"So you came out to see for yourself," Wynne concluded.
He took a deep breath and said, "I like her."
"I liked a girl once, when I was your age," Morgan said, steepling his fingers. "Her name was Veronica. She was new to Mullaby, too. All I wanted to do was spend all day staring at her. I asked her to a matinee, and your grandfather found out. He slapped me, then locked me in my room. When I didn't show up at the movie theater, Veronica came to the house to ask if I was all right. Your grandfather was horrible to her. He told her that my asking her out was just a joke. She hated me after that, but he made his point."
"What point?"
"That we weren't made for normal lives."
"Did your father treat your brother the same way?" Wynne asked as he took a seat on the couch.
"The rules weren't any different for Logan."
Wynne had never known that his grandfather hit his father. Wynne remembered the old man vaguely. He was very quiet when Wynne knew him. People used to say he was never the same after his youngest son, Logan, committed suicide. It made sense now that Logan and Dulcie Shelby had to sneak around. Wynne's grandfather obviously would have slapped Logan and locked him in his room if he'd found out. It all seemed so ridiculous now, the extreme measures, the furtive prowling. The secret was out, and it couldn't be taken back.
"It's different now," Wynne said. "You say that as if different is better," Morgan said. "If we wait long enough, people will forget what they saw, and things can go back to the way they were. It's just a matter of time. Sometimes I even hope your mother has forgotten."
"I don't want to go back to the way things were."
"You don't have a choice. You're grounded, and you're not allowed to associate with Emily anymore."
That wasn't unexpected. "That girl you liked, didn't you ever want to tell her?" Morgan uncrossed his legs, then crossed them again. He stared at his cuticles a while.
"No," he finally said. "I liked the illusion. When I was with her, I was...
normal," Wynne finished for him. Morgan nodded.
"It was like that with your mother for a while. Then Logan was tricked into showing everyone what we could do. Your mother and I had only been married for 2 years. Nothing has been the same. She's never forgiven me for not telling her, for making her find out with the rest of the town."
Every coffee man had a different way of telling the woman he married, but it was always after the ceremony. A tradition, like all the others, that made no sense. Wynne had often wondered if Logan had never revealed the family secret, would his father have ever even told his mother?
"Mom loves you," Wynne said, certain that it had been true at least once.
Morgan got up and headed for the front door.
"She loves me in the daytime. Everyone loves us in the daytime. Trust me on this, Wynne. I'm trying to save you some misery."
Chapter 14. Julia parked her truck by the dumpster behind the restaurant and thought, What in the hell have I just done? Sawyer had gotten her so mad that she'd slept with him. Or was that really the reason? Maybe it had just been the excuse she'd needed. But everything was messed up now. She didn't know what to do. There was no goal now, no plan. And now she had to go into her restaurant, which was already packed, wearing the same clothes she'd been wearing yesterday and smelling of him. She adjusted the rearview mirror and looked at herself. God, she even had beard burn. She groaned and put her head on the steering wheel. She could go home, she supposed, but then people might come by and ask where she'd been, if something was wrong. It wasn't worth all the additional explaining, and Sunday was the busiest day at the restaurant, the day that brought in the most money. She had to do this. She tried to smooth her hair back a little, but it didn't help much. She sighed and got out. Coming in through the back meant walking a few steps into the seating area itself, just past the restrooms. She tried to sneak in, but found herself stopping when she saw just how full the place was. She knew how well the business was doing from a financial standpoint, but it was an entirely different experience to see it for herself. Her father would have loved this. He would have been out there talking to people, making them feel welcome, catching up on news. For a moment, she could even see him in his t-shirt and jeans, ball cap and half apron. He was a wisp of a man, another ghost in her life. But then someone passed by her line of vision and she lost him. She suddenly wondered, when she left this place, would he still be here? Would his memory live on?
Hey, Julia,
someone called from a table, and several people turned to her. More people called out, a few waved. A couple of old ladies she'd gone to church with when she was a kid even got up to invite her to the Sunday night service. Normally she was here so early that she never saw these people. Oh, she would see them in the grocery store and on the street, but they were never this friendly. For some reason, seeing her here made it different for them. Here she was the restaurant owner. She was the reason they still had this place to come to gather, to socialize. Here she was Jim's daughter, and they saw in that something to be admired. Julia smiled at them, a little dazed, and sidestepped her way into the kitchen. Hours later, in the thick of the lunch rush, Julia finally finished her cakes. They were being sliced and served even as she stood behind the counter and wrote the names of the day's cakes on the chalkboard. She didn't know it, but while she was in the kitchen, her stepmother, Beverly, had come in, but obviously not to eat. She was waiting for Julia at a table near the door. When she got up, the couple she'd been sitting with looked relieved.
"Julia!"
Beverly said as she approached, waving a large brown envelope. Several men looked her way.
"I stopped by Stella Ferris's house looking for you, because you're never here at the restaurant at lunchtime. What are you doing here at lunchtime? You're only here in the morning. Everyone knows that. You should set a routine and stick to it."
Julia was too tired, both emotionally and physically, to deal with Beverly today. She set the chalkboard down. "Let's talk some other time, Beverly. I'm exhausted, and I want to go home." And where was that exactly, she thought? Her apartment at Stella's? Her dad's old house? Baltimore? Nothing was clear anymore.
"No, no, no. I'm put out enough with you already, Missy. If I had known you'd be here, I would have come here first instead of stopping at Stella's house and waiting for you. That woman is such an odd duck. What are you doing here at lunchtime?" she asked again. "You're never here at lunchtime."
"I own this place, Beverly. I can come and go any time I please."
"Speaking of which, excuse me, hon," she said to a man sitting at the counter as she hipped her way between him and the man beside him.
It was a tight fit, but she didn't seem to mind. Neither did the men.
"Here's the surprise I was talking about."
She slapped the envelope on the counter in front of Julia.
"Your father would be so proud of me. I had my lawyer draw up partnership papers for this place. All you have to do is sign over half of Jay's barbecue to me. That way, when we sell it, we can split the profit."
The men on either side of Beverly looked at Julia curiously, waiting, as Beverly was, for her to say something. People at a nearby table heard, too. The news soon made its way around the room like smoke. Julia stared at the envelope on the counter. This shouldn't have mattered, but it did. Just like last night shouldn't have mattered, but it did. At least a full minute passed before Beverly began to look uncomfortable.
"Now, Julia, you know I deserve this."
She leaned in and said in a softer voice,
"I thought we had an understanding."
"My understanding," Julia said, finally looking up from the envelope,
"is that my father loved you, but you left him."
That had the restaurant quiet in seconds. Beverly scooped up the envelope.
"Obviously you're cranky. From the look of you, you haven't had much sleep. And don't think I haven't noticed that those are the same clothes you were wearing yesterday. Clean up a little, and I'll meet you outside."
"No, Beverly, this ends here," Julia said, and it all came flooding out. "You were everything to him, to the detriment of his relationship with me. I ceased to exist when you came into his life. These scars you like to point out every time you see me were because he wouldn't look at me once you appeared. He worked damn hard at this business, but it was never good enough for you, was it? When it stopped making money, as paltry as it had been, you left him. Do you honestly think I'm going to give you half of it? That you deserve it?"
Beverly pursed her thin lips, which were lined in pearly peach. "You could learn a thing or two about casting stones. You left him first, and you were the reason he was so deeply in debt. It was all your fault, Missy, so don't get all high and mighty on me."
Julia couldn't believe her gall. "How could I be the reason he was in debt?" Beverly laughed resentfully.
"How do you think he paid for that reformatory you went to? What little he made was still too much to apply for aid, and because you were from out of state, the fee was even higher. He mortgaged everything he had for you, you ungrateful girl. And I still didn't leave him then. I only left when Bud started showing an interest in me, and your father didn't say a word about it. He stopped appreciating me a long time ago. All he talked about was you. How you were the first in the family to go to college. How you lived in the big city. How you were making your dream come true. He conveniently forgot that you tried to shred yourself to pieces, that you got knocked up at 16, that you took all his money and then never came back to see him."
Julia could see the surprise on the faces of some people in the restaurant. What people didn't know about the scars on her arms, they inferred, but no one knew she'd been pregnant when she left. As blindsided as she was by this news, by what her father had sacrificed for her, something in her mind clicked, and it made perfect sense. He'd never been good at expressing himself. She'd spent a long time in therapy, trying to adjust her expectations, especially from the men in her life. She'd thought she'd wanted grand gestures and expressive declarations because her father never gave her that. Sometimes she thought that even falling for Sawyer when she was a teenager, how larger than life he was looking for something missing in her relationship with her father. But how could she have missed this? Everything her father did was quiet, even loving her. The tragedy was that no one in her father's life had ever understood that. Everyone had left him because they hadn't been quiet enough to hear him. Not until it was too late. But no, she thought, it wasn't too late. Tears came to Julia's eyes. She wiped them away. She couldn't believe she was doing this in front of everyone. "He was a good, uncomplicated man," Julia said. "And he deserved better than us both. You're not going to get any piece of this restaurant, Beverly. No one is. This was the one thing that never let him down, his only constant. Too many people have taken too many things from him, as it is. She pointed to the door. You're not welcome here, ever again.
Oh, I'll be back, Beverly said, sashaying to the door. When you leave, I'll be right back in here, and there won't be a thing you can do about it.
I'll be sure she knows she's not welcome, Charlotte, the day manager, said from behind Julia.
So will I, the new waitress said.
I'll remind her, one of the men at the counter said.
Me too,
said someone across the room. The restaurant then became a chorus of agreement. Beverly looked aghast. She glared at Julia.
See, this is what you do. You go and leave all sorts of trouble behind.
I've got news for you, Julia said. I'm not leaving. The restaurant erupted into applause as Beverly left. Julia stood there, breathing heavily, and thought again, what in the hell have I just done?
There you are, Stella said,
meeting her at the door when Julia finally got home. She was wearing what she called her day gown, a silk robe with buttons her mother had given her. She said it made her feel like a lady of leisure.
I've been so worried. Where were you last night? Even your evil stepmother came by looking for you.
Why did you sleep with Sawyer? Julia blurted out, right there in the foyer. She hadn't meant to say it. She was as surprised as Stella looked.
What?
Stella said. Sawyer said you slept together 3 years ago. Do you love him?
Oh, that, Stella said. It was terrible. Not the sex, at least what I remember of it. But I was a mess. My divorce had just been finalized and all my money was gone. Sawyer came by that evening to give me a bottle of champagne to celebrate my freedom. I got drunk and I climbed all over him. I'm not proud of it. Believe me, I never wanted to be the woman men had sex with out of pity. It was just once, and I tried to avoid him after that, but he wouldn't let me. Sawyer's a good guy, a good friend.
Why do you ask? Stella clutched at her heart dramatically.
Oh, my God! That's where you were last night! You totally did it with Sawyer!
Julia didn't answer, but she must have given something away with her look. Stella drew her into her arms for a tight hug.
I'm so happy. That man has always had a thing for you. I have no idea why he waited so long. I used to tease him that he was afraid of you.
She took Julia's hand and led her to the living room, where she had been fortifying herself with a pitcher of Bloody Marys.
So tell me everything. What happened? When? How many times?
Julia shook her head as she sat down and accepted the drink Stella gave her.
Uh-uh. No way. You have to tell me. You're my best friend, Stella said, which startled Julia. It's the code. I tell you everything that's happening in my life.
You didn't tell me about Sawyer, she said, taking the celery stalk out of the drink and biting into it.
Sawyer isn't happening in my life. He already happened, a long time ago.
Julia set the glass back on the tray. Am I really your best friend?
Of course you are.
But you used to laugh at me in high school. Surprised, Stella sat down heavily on the chair opposite Julia.
High school was a long time ago.
Are you saying you can't be my best friend now because of what happened back then? No, Julia said, being honest with herself for the first time in a long time. Her friendships in Baltimore had never felt like this. Her friends there had accepted her for who they thought she was. Stella accepted her for who she really was. This place defined her. It always had. Stella knew that. I think you're the best friend I've ever had.
That's more like it, Stella said. Now, tell me everything.
The first thing Sawyer said when Julia opened the door a few hours later was,
Let's get this out of the way. There's nothing going on between me and Holly.
Julia leaned against the door jamb. It was so nice to see him, but there was so much that needed to be said. The two of you look good together. You match. Have you ever considered getting back together?
I don't want to match. Holly is selling me her part of the house we own together here. She's getting remarried in a couple of weeks. She's pregnant. I completely forgot she was coming to town this weekend.
That was my fault. Sorry.
Don't be sorry. Do it again.
He tried to step into her apartment, but she froze, her hand on the doorknob. He stepped back.
You don't want me to come in?
No, it's not that. It's just, I've always treated this place as temporary. There's not much to it. After all this time, she couldn't believe she was still embarrassed.
I don't care what your apartment looks like.
Automatic response, sorry.
She opened the door wider.
He stepped inside with a deep breath and a satisfied smile. He put his hands on his hips and looked like he'd conquered the new world.
I've wanted up here ever since you've been back, and it's not what you're thinking. On Thursdays when I have pizza with Stella, that incredible smell from whatever you happen to be baking, it never fails to make me heady.
Could you see it? Julia asked.
I can always see it. It's on you now, sparkling in your hair.
He pointed to her hand. You have some in the cuff of your sleeve, too. Julia turned the cuff inside out, and sure enough, flour and sugar from that morning sprinkled out. That's amazing.
Are you going to give me a tour?
Sawyer asked. We can do it from here. She pointed to each door. Bedroom, bathroom, kitchen, living room. She led him to the tiny living room and invited him to take a seat. She remained standing, too nervous to sit. Stella's mother gave me that love seat. I have a nice couch of my own in storage up in Baltimore.
Do you think you'll bring it down?
I don't know. He sat back, obviously making a concerted effort not to push the subject.
Did you actually get into a fight with Beverly at your restaurant this morning?
That made Julia suddenly laugh. Did Stella tell you, or did word travel that fast?
Both. What happened?
I had a few things to get off my chest.
So did she, apparently. I heard that you said you weren't selling the restaurant, he said, carefully.
What can I say? I'm as surprised as you are.
What about your 2-year plan?
He hesitated.
Does this mean you're staying?
She didn't answer right away. You know that big thing I wanted to tell you? I'm going to tell you now. Then I'm going to leave you alone to let you think about it, okay? A guarded look came to his face.
Alone as in leaving and never coming back?
Alone as in leaving this apartment for a walk, she said. Then, who knows?
Okay, he said. Lay it on me.
Stay right there. She went to her bedroom and reached under her bed, feeling around until she found the old algebra textbook she'd hidden there. She opened the book and looked at the two photos she had of her baby, Sawyer's baby. She'd put the photos in this book when she was at Collier and could never think of anywhere else to store them. She set the book on her bed and took the photos to the living room. She felt jumpy, and her skin was alive with 1,000 prickles. He looked up at her as she entered. Before she could talk herself out of it, she held the photos out to him, and he took them. She watched as he looked at them, confused at first, then alert. He met her eyes with a short, quick jerk of his head. She was born on May 5th, she said. 6 pounds, 6 ounces. She looked nothing like me, and everything like you. Blonde hair and blue eyes. A couple from Washington, D.C. adopted her.
I have a daughter?
She nodded, then left before he could ask any more questions. Heat radiated from the metal bleachers in blurry, undulating light. Julia's spot when she was a teenager was where the top bleacher butted against the enclosed media box, forming a pocket of concrete shade. She hadn't been here since she was 16. It felt different, but eerily the same. From here, she could see down onto the 50-yard line, where it had all happened, where her life had changed. The lumbering brick school building on the far side of the field was quiet, but the windows were open, indicating that teachers were in their classrooms, getting ready for the new school year. The cafeteria was on the ground floor and faced the field. She thought of what Sawyer had said about how he used to watch her on the bleachers at lunch. She'd been there for at least an hour, wondering how much time he needed with this, or if all the time in the world wouldn't be enough, when something suddenly caught her eye, and on the left side of the field, she saw Sawyer walking toward her. He stopped at the base of the bleachers and looked up at her. The photos were in his hand. It was hard to tell his expression. Was he mad? Would this change everything all over again? The protective part of her steeled herself for that possibility, even though she knew she wasn't as easily hurt as she'd been when she was 16. She had a lot fewer expectations than she did then. She had a very long list of things she would never have, and Sawyer had always been on that list, along with her daughter, long fingers, and the ability to turn back time. He started up the bleachers toward her. The first step he took, he was 16, blonde and cherubic, the wish every girl in school made when she blew out candles on her birthday cake. With every step he took, he got older, the cherubic cheeks giving way to sharper cheekbones, his skin growing more golden, his hair a darker blonde. By the time he reached her, he was the Sawyer of today, of this morning, of last night. Without a word, he sat beside her. "How did you know I'd be here?" she asked, because even she didn't know she'd be here until she'd walked by and saw the school. Just a hunch. "Go ahead," she said. "Ask."
"I don't have to ask the big question. I know why you didn't tell me."
She nodded. "Okay."
"Do you know where she is now? What she's doing?"
He looked at the photos.
"Her name?"
"No." She tugged on the cuffs of her sleeves. "The papers are sealed. I can't find her unless she wants to find me." "You said you followed the scent home when your mother baked, so I have it in my head, in my heart, that if I just keep baking, she'll find me, that this will bring her home." Julia looked down, then across the field, anywhere but him. "I think she has your sweet sense. I couldn't eat enough cake to satisfy her when I was pregnant."
"That's what my mother said when she was pregnant with me."
"I wanted to keep her so badly," she said. "For a long time, I was angry at everyone for not helping me make that happen. It took a while to realize that it was just misplaced guilt because I wasn't well enough to care for her on my own." He was the one to look away this time.
"Saying I'm sorry doesn't feel like enough. I feel like I owe you so much more. I owe you for her."
He shook his head. "I can't believe I have a daughter." "You don't owe me anything," she said. "She was a gift."
"Your hair is still pink in this photo."
He lifted the one of her holding the baby in the hospital.
"When did you stop dyeing it?"
"When I went up to school. I cut it all off shortly after that photo was taken."
"When did you start with the pink streak?"
Julia nervously tucked it behind her ear. "In college. My friends in Baltimore think I do it to be edgy. But I do it because it reminds me of what I can get through, of what I have gotten through. It reminds me not to give up." There was a long silence. A maintenance man on a riding lawnmower drove onto the football field and started taking wide loops around it. Julia and Sawyer watched him.
"Are you going to stay?"
Sawyer finally asked. How did she answer that? He was being very calm. She had no idea how he really felt. I spent so much time telling myself that this wasn't home that I started to believe it, she said carefully. Belonging has always been tough for me.
I can be your home, he said quietly.
Belong to me. She stared at him, stunned by his whispered grand gesture, until he turned to her. When he saw the tears in her eyes, he reached for her. She held on to him and cried. Cried for so long her throat ached. Cried until the football field was all mown and the air smelled of cut grass and bugs swarmed the track. To think, after all this time, after all the searching and all the waiting, after all the regret and the time she'd spent away, she came back to find that happiness was right where she'd left it, on a football field in Mullaby, North Carolina, waiting for her. Chapter 15. Emily stuffed her hands in her shorts pockets as she walked down the sidewalk that night. There were no cars out, but she kept listening for them, stepping into the darkness in between each streetlight and pausing, waiting for some indication that Wynne had invited the whole town to this, like her mother had done. Since coming to Mullaby, Emily had discovered that her disbelief could be suspended further than she ever thought it could, and there was a small part of her that wondered, what if it was true? If giants exist, if wallpaper can change on its own, why couldn't Wynne do what he said he could do? If it was real, that meant this wasn't about revenge. This wasn't about what her mother had done. The closer she got, the more she wanted it to be true. When she reached Main Street, she stopped on the sidewalk by the park. No one was there. Gray-green moonlight illuminated the area, and the shadows from the trees in the back looked like brittle witches' fingers reaching across the grass toward her. She took a step into the park, then made herself walk to the bandstand. She stood a few feet away from the main staircase and stared up at it, all the way up to the crescent moon weather vane. Then she turned back to the street to see if Wynne was coming from that direction.
You came. I didn't think you would.
His voice startled her, coming out of nowhere. Where are you? She called into the park, her eyes darting around, the shadows playing tricks on her.
Behind you.
She spun back to the bandstand. Her hands had started shaking, so she curled them into fists, her fingernails biting into her palms. Looking closely,